Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Alia Malik, begins her prologue in her new memoir in Damascus, May 2013. She writes, quote, "By the time I left Syria, many in my family were happy to see me go. For them, the day hadn't come soon enough," end quote. While most foreign journalists were denied legal access to Syria, Malia Alec had been able to enter and move around Damascus with relative ease. While she was there, she helped her family reclaim her grandmother's apartment, which had been lost since 1970 when Hafez al-Assad came to power. She also wrote pieces for The New York Times, The Nation, and the Christian Science Monitor, but they were without a byline. Alia Malik writes about her experience in the home that was our country. It's a multi-generational family memoir that shines a light on Syrian history, society, and politics. Alia Malik is an award-winning Syrian-American journalist, author, and civil rights lawyer. She has written for many publications, including the Columbia Journalism Review. Her new book is called The Home That Was Our Country, A Memoir of Syria. Alia will be speaking on Monday, May 8th at Green Apple Books on the Park in San Francisco, 1231 9th Avenue, and the event starts at 7:30. And Alia Malik joins us in studio. Hi, Alia. Thank you so much for coming in.
It's great to actually be here with you, physically with you.
Yes, it's great to meet you in person. We're going to dive in and talk about your book, but since this is our media roundtable and you now are a journalist, I wanted to ask you, just what did you see this week that you thought was done well? We always like to start off on a positive note and highlight good journalism.
Well, one of the nice things about being 3 hours behind the East Coast is I feel like a little bit less connected than I usually am. And I was reading a lot of stuff about what happened with healthcare in Congress. But in terms of Syria specifically, there was an interesting blog piece in Foreign Policy about how Russia is using now Chechen and Sunni Russian forces, Russians who are ethnically from the parts of Russia that have a lot of Sunni Muslims, are using those kinds of ground troops increasingly in Syria as a way, you know, some of its, you know, to sort of soften, I guess, its presence in Syria and make it seem like it's less of a foreign presence. And it went into sort of the dynamics behind that. And I thought it sort of took apart pretty well how the interests in Syria, whether it's on the side of the regime or against the regime, they might line up on some issues, but it's, you know, these aren't ideological lineups. So it was, you know, a very interesting look at the sort of international relations that are going on in Syria.
So that piece was in Foreign Policy. Mm-hmm. Where else are you going to read about Syria and what's happening there?
I mean, things operate on different levels. Syria Deeply is a really good place for journalism that focuses specifically on Syria. For more analysis, there's a lot of intelligence stuff on Jadalia. You know, I'm a history buff, so I'm frequently listening to the Ottoman History podcast. There was a really good show a few weeks ago with an academic who has a new book out by Princeton University Press that focuses specifically on the history of the Alawites. And I think this is sort of important because we're taking for granted a lot of sort of the sectarian terms on which we're speaking about the Syrian conflict. So I'm a big believer in history. You know, for your day-to-day stuff, you know, the BBC, The Economist, even the New York Times, the Washington Post, there's a lot of good stuff. I mean, there are, you know, a lot of the journalists who have been there for a while, and they do their best to keep up with the day-to-day breaking news.
And we will put links to those websites up right after the show at yourcallradio.org. Before we dive in and talk about your book, I just wanted to know a little bit more about you, because so many people are writing books these days and you just wonder, well, who is this person? What is their personal experience? And what I loved about your book is that you wrote a lot about history. You learned so much about Syrian history, but it's also very personal for you.
Well, for whatever reasons, we're in a place now, especially with Arabs or Muslims or Syrians or anybody who's kind of an other, where we have to personalize the story to keep the reader's attention, and we have to make things kind of entertaining. You know, I say this, you know, let's for better and for worse, this is sort of the situation that we're in. And specifically when it comes to Arabs and Muslims who have been so specifically demonized, you know, I think it's really hard to take those those arguments apart in just an academic or just a polemical way. And I have found there's so much resistance to finding out about these people on their own terms that the only way is, you know, for me, I have felt that I've had to operate in nonfiction and I've had to operate with using real people's lives, because it's the one, it's kind of almost a defense to anyone's resistance to saying, well, you know, you made this seem a lot, you made them seem nicer than they really are, or you've created a story that's meant to pull at my heartstrings. But if I can say, no, this is nonfiction, this is real, and I show you these people and their complexities, and my characters are never perfect, I think that's also something that we have to be okay with. I shouldn't have to have model minority characters for you to empathize with them. And I think actually it doesn't work with readers. You know, I don't think they have as much interest in the story. And so I did this with my first book, Amrika. And when I can in long form, I try to use a person to allow readers to live that moment of time in the skin of somebody. But it was a harder decision deciding to use my own family for that. But, you know, the story of Syria is so large and so vast, and people were getting spread out so quickly that it seemed that to keep a reader with me from the beginning, which where the book starts in really 1889 all the way to the end to 2016, I needed to have some kind of unifying force, which is the building, the house, and my family. But my family sort of interacted with so many different people that I think readers get also an introduction to that diversity.
You grew up in Baltimore. You're the daughter of Syrian immigrants. You became a civil rights attorney. At what point did you decide to become a writer and then write a memoir and share so much personal information about yourself and your family?
Well, growing up in the 70s and the 80s as an Arab, I sort of felt very much the subject of journalism and the subject of writing, even if it wasn't specifically about me. But that's sort of how it works when you're not seen as an individual but seen as part of a collective. And that kind of prejudice and discrimination that was caused by those kinds of, you know, the knowledge that was put out into the world, specifically the United States about us, led me to want to become a civil rights lawyer, because I felt that there was so much discrimination that when it was legally actionable, then there's a role that I could play in that. And also it was sort of a very conscious way of positioning myself in a part of America that I felt had space for me. It was very sympathetic to when I learn more about African American history, you know, the initial history of like colonizing, you know, a place of colonialism and a place of genocide and a place of slavery, like that's a hard narrative to feel a part of when you're also coming from outside. And I thought that becoming a civil rights lawyer and working on behalf of all kinds of people, that I was sort of like taking a position in where I wanted to see myself in American society, and also, you know, as Arab Americans, adding our visible presence to those issues. But after 9/11, it seemed to me that the discourse and the antipathy had gotten to such a level that it was no longer enough just to deal with the sort of the effects of discrimination as they became legally actionable, but that I needed to play a role in what knowledge was created about Arabs and Muslims. And so I began to think about transitioning into a career of journalism and sort of like trying to correct, or not correct, but not just complain, but also maybe proactively, you know, create some of the knowledge that we have about these groups of people. So that's how the transition came. And like I said, the choice to do, this is not Eat, Pray, Love, Damascus. So when we call it a memoir, there's no, you know, I'm not falling in love with my yoga teacher in Damascus or anything like that. But, you know, it was a way just to, you know, that was a conscious choice, I think, by the publishers to call it a memoir. And it is in some sense. Mm-hmm. But yes, it's not going to be salacious.
Yeah. No. But you do learn a lot about how we got here. And before we dive in, what do you think are the biggest misconceptions based on the conversations that you're hearing and some of the media that you're reading about what's happening right now in Syria?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the biggest one I would say is that using the sectarian lens to understand what's going on in Syria is pretty simplistic. Yes, there are Sunnis and Alawites and Christians and Kurds and all the different peoples that make up Syria. But, you know, just like in the United States, amongst white Americans, differences in class and sexuality and geography can really differentiate a person's politics. The same holds true in Syria. But for whatever reason, we seem to think that all Sunnis must be a monolith and that all Alawites are a monolith. And we understand what's going on there, and we understand the consequences of power and the allotments of power on those terms is so faulty that there's no way we're going to come up with the right solutions. And I would say that's the number one misconception and that we have to work against. And then more generally, this idea that a people wouldn't have differences according to class or whether they're urban or rural or, you know, rich or poor or how they see themselves in the world, educated, not educated, that those differences wouldn't exist. I don't know why we would expect those differences not to exist when we can see that they exist very much for us here in this country.
What about information? What do you think people need to know at this point?
Well, they obviously need to know a lot more. What do they need to know?
And what do you think's missing?
A lot. I mean, I think what's missing is that people sort of see the world, and I've seen this happen here in the United States, specifically in Syria. You know, they see this as a left or a right issue, or an imperialism or anti-imperialism issue, mm-hmm. intervention issue or anti-intervention issue. And they sort of plot Syrians in as characters in that kind of a story, right? This is the storyline has already been established, and they think, you know, we can use Iraq, we can talk about Iraqis this way, we can talk about Syrians this way, we can talk about Palestinians this way. And the reality is all these places have their own specificity. And, you know, we are in a place, for whatever reason, we have a resistance to specificity. But, you know, that's what I seek to do in my work, to sort of recreate the specificity. Also, women's voices are missing. Mm-hmm. The voices of people who choose not to take arms, which is the vast majority of people. You know, we talk a lot, we focus a lot on the actions of armed groups, whether it's the regime or the opposition to the regime. But that's not where Syria, you know, it's not where the Syrian people or Syrian society, you know, lies completely. And that's definitely not where the future will be. And, you know, we talk so much about ISIS, obviously, and we don't talk about the context that gave rise to ISIS. And I think you're not going to be able to understand or come up with any kinds of solutions if you're dropping in on this story today or even just 6 years ago. And the other thing, wow, you've opened the floodgates. And the other thing that I think we need to think about is that where does the clock start ticking when you want to understand this conflict? You know, and a lot of people, you know, we could start with the invasion of Iraq, the American invasion of Iraq, which really destabilized the region. But maybe, you know, were we normalizing this Assad regime even before? We, you know, America rendered during the war, its war on terror, the Bush administration, Bush Jr., rendered people to be tortured in Syrian prisons so we wouldn't be technically torturing them in U.S. prisons. You know, Bush's father normalized Bashar al-Assad's father by sort of, because he needed Syrians to participate in the coalition that invaded Iraq the first time. So where does the clock start ticking, and what part have we played in that? Which doesn't say to put a full blame on it, but how do we think our intentions are evaluated by people in the region if we're not honest about what our own behaviors have looked like to the people on the ground there?
Today we're speaking with Alia Malik, an award-winning Syrian-American journalist. She's out with a new book, The Home That Was Our Country, A Memoir of Syria. And the book shines a light on Syrian history, society, and politics. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions or comments for Alia, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What about the latest news that's coming out about Russia, Iran, and Turkey signing a memorandum to create four so-called safe zones in Syria? According to the New York Times, these areas are rebel-held areas where displaced Syrian civilians could voluntarily return. What does this mean for Syrians inside the country and the millions of people who've left?
Well, I mean, we're going to have to wait and see, because that there, it's been clear that none of the actors that you've named have behaved at all times in good faith, particularly the Syrian regime. So, you know, where the last chemical attacks happened, those were places to which Syrians had been evacuated to, who had been in rebel-held areas, and that attack was, you know, was launched on them. So we'll, you know, wait and see. You do have, what is correct is that you have to bring all the stakeholders to the table. But one of the reasons it's been hard to come, which includes Iran, Russia, the Syrian regime, Turkey, but one of the things that's been a factor that I think people have not understood from the outside is that while Russia, Iran, and the Syrian regime are, you know, in theory on one side of the table, not all their interests align. And Bashar al-Assad's regime has been very smart in or savvy in that by having two backers, Iran and Russia, who don't necessarily have the same goals, they've been able to play the spoiler. Well, you know, they've been able to play them off of each other. So they don't all have the same goals. So we'll have to see. You know, the Syrian regime is most invested in staying in power with Bashar al-Assad as its head. But now, do the Russians really care about Bashar? That's really up for debate. I think the Russians would be happy with any stooge. But the Iranians maybe care a little bit more about Bashar, and if it's not Bashar, would be more interested in replacing him with somebody from his family, such as his brother Maher. So, you know, how all these three players, they don't all have the same interest. So let's see. And the one thing that they all share in common is that they don't care how many Syrians die in the furtherance of their own interests. So that's the one thing that you can always bet on, that more Syrian civilians are going to be bearing the consequences of whatever more greater strategies these three players have, or any people who line up on the other side as well, on the opposition side.
We know that 11 million people have been displaced from their homes. That's more than half of the population. The population's about 17 million now?
Inside Syria.
Syria. And then what about deaths? Because in so many reports, it just says hundreds of thousands. Mercy Corps has the number at 470,000 people.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when the dust clears, we'll have a better idea, because there are so many people who are unaccounted for who are in those prisons and, obviously not with any kind of legal process that would let us know that they are there. I mean, and we're getting glimpses at numbers through, for example, the Caesar pictures, the regime photographer who defected and brought out that USB. So that's how we got one number of dead and unaccounted for. But we also know from, I think it was the Amnesty report a few months ago, of the people that were being executed in Sadnaya, I think it was in the Sadnaya prison. And the way they knew is that prisoners would see the slippers that were left behind. So they were counting the slippers of prisoners. So no, we won't have affirmative numbers, I think, for a while. But whatever it is, it's already just an inconceivable number.
What does this potential deal mean for civilians?
Well, there have been a lot of potential. Do you mean one that was just the safe zone?
I mean, are you in touch with groups that are working with refugees? I mean, it's so difficult to comprehend what so many people are dealing with, just trying to find a place to land, so many in transit, missing their family members. I mean, this is just such a tragedy. What is in store for these people?
I think people, like I said, people have many reasons not to believe that the regime or its backers are acting in good faith. So, you know, like I said, all those people had just been evacuated to Idlib region when the chemical attack came after them. I think everyone understands that they're a pawn. And I don't think there's any Syrian who really believes that any of these major players has their best interests at heart.
Let's talk a little bit about your family and why you decided to go back to Syria.
Well, so when my parents first came here, it was never with the intent to stay. In fact, all of their kids were born American well before they were ever finally decided to become naturalized, because the plan was always to go back. My dad came over in 1969 and my mom came over in 1974 pregnant with me. So for my mom, she had been there for the first four years of Hafez al-Assad's regime, and had already seen Syria begun to change and had her doubts. But, you know, I think what people don't realize, and I know this because they've written nasty emails at me, that Syria is a beautiful place. Mm. My parents never intended to live in a place as lonely and, you know, as uninteresting as Baltimore seemed to them to be in the 1970s. You know, they came from a capital, from a place of beautiful weather and beautiful trees and beautiful people. And so they wanted to go back. But then when it became clear that things were changing, they still thought about going back. But in 1980, there was a murder of a family member that was committed with impunity, as many things have been committed with in the last 40 years. And that began to make them feel that, you know, I think a lot of people in Syria felt that the rules were sort of transparent. If you play by the rules, which means do not dissent, do not exercise free speech, do not question the authority of the totalitarian regime, that you could have had, as circumscribed as it was, a pleasant enough life. But then when a murder happened so arbitrarily and with such impunity, I think that that made them think that, no, maybe even if you play by the rules, you will still suffer the effects of this regime. And then we also lost our house. And the house that was intended for my mom to raise her family in 1970, my grandmother had rented it out to an army man. The same, you know, within months, Hafez al-Assad came to power, another man of the military. And it was for a fixed term. And in the end, as I say, neither the tenant nor the dictator would leave. But then in 2010, we had gotten the house back. So we were resigned to a life in diaspora and frequent, you know, fond visits home, but that we were never going to be able to be actualized versions of ourselves. And then once I became a human rights lawyer and then a journalist, you know, that was basically sealed my fate. These are occupations that are hazardous to your health in a totalitarian regime like Syria. But then in 2010, we got our house back, and something seemed to give in the Middle East, in the region with the Arab Spring, and specifically also inside Syria, that maybe we were on the sort of precipice of something new. And I had this observable reason to all the secret police who might be watching me, this Syrian-American human rights lawyer, journalist, why I was in the country. Well, I was restoring the house. And I felt that something was coming to Syria, and granted, I thought it was a good thing that might be coming to Syria, and I wanted to be part of the knowledge that was created about that moment. I speak Arabic. I understand Syria, I think, much more than a lot of the journalists who sort of parachute in these moments. And I don't mean this just by virtue of the fact of being Syrian. I had lived and worked in the region. I lived in Lebanon and the West Bank, Gaza. This is a subject of professional interest and study. So I thought, you know, why not? I kind of had a cover story. I could be there and maybe produce better, you know, the kind of journalism we would need so that people might have an empathy towards the place as whatever decisions would need to be made about its fate, because they would be made at a more global international level, because that's the way it kind of goes for people in the developing world.
Do you think that people who speak with such authority about Syria know what your parents had to deal with, for example? I mean, you talk about the changes that your mom and dad were feeling about speech being stifled. You have to play by the rules.
Well, who are we talking about? I think there are so many amazing academics that really have, because they've been studying Syria for a long time, and they don't study Syria as just something that was born 6 years ago with this conflict in the so-called Arab Spring. But, I mean, I don't own a TV, I think, partly for these reasons, because, when I do catch people speaking about Syria on TV, it's oftentimes, I just, you know, it's very curious to me that they are experts on Syria. But yes, I think part of the problem is we understand, like I said earlier, we sort of have these plots that we understand, you know, the way we look at the world, and we sort of plug Syria into that. So if people came to understand Iraq as Sunni versus Shia, then we sort of took that mode of analysis and put it on top of Syria and tried to understand it. And I think a lot of people who believed that they could just arm a few people and that everything would change and the regime would fall, I think there were a lot of people in the United States, in the White House, in, you know, specifically, who did not understand Syria, who did not understand that this Bashar al-Assad's regime is a continuation of his father's regime. They did not really understand the nature of the regime and the nature of the sort of psychological project that has been, you know, played on Syrians over the last 40 years. I was amazed at the, and I don't work in a public health space, but like there, even I as a dilettante could see like the sort of Stockholm syndrome that was affecting people and the level of fear. I think people here never understood the level of fear that Syrians had of their own government. And so when, you know, John McCain or other people say, you know, why don't we just need to arm them and then they'll fight for their country? Well, this is a country, this is a people that knew that the regime would use massive violence against them, as it had done in Hama in 1980, the town that my grandmother's from, and sort of putting down any kind of opposition in this sort of like almost nuclear, you know, it's not a precision fashion in which the Syrian regime works. And yes, I think we vastly did not understand this country.
Today, we're speaking with Aliyah Malik, an award-winning Syrian-American journalist, about her new book, The Home That Was Our Country, a memoir of Syria. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
I'm Matt Martin, general manager of KALW, here with Malihe Razazan, senior producer of Your Call, asking for your support for this incredible conversation you're hearing on Your Call today, for this program you hear every day of the week on KALW, and for the station that brings it to you.
Matt, I have to say this is a very difficult show for me to listen to because of the destruction, both physical and emotional, that people in Syria have endured in the past 6 years. But at the same time, we are privileged to have someone like Alia Malik in this studio to be able to talk to and also to connect with our listeners. If you support this kind of program, this kind of journalism, on the ground journalism, do support KLW. It really does matter at a time that we get so much soundbite and so much news that is truly not real. It's not based on reality and it's not based on facts and experience. Do support KLW. Do support Your Call by calling 1-800-525-9917, kalw.org, 800-525-9917, or click klw.org and donate generously online, klw.org. Matt?
And when you go to the website, you will see The Home That Was Our Country, A Memoir of Syria by Alia Malik right there on the front page. And for a $120 contribution to KALW, we will be happy to give you a copy of this book as our thanks for your support. Maliha, I loved what Alia was saying, talking about what it would take to be able to do empathic journalism.
Exactly.
And on the Friday Media Roundtable, the kind of journalists who really say, who are the people I'm covering? What would it be like if I were in their shoes? That's the kind of journalism we ask you to support when you make a call or click 800-525-9917, KALW.org. Thank you. Back to the program.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are joined by Alia Malik, an award-winning Syrian-American journalist, author, and civil rights lawyer. She's out with a new book, The Home That Was Our Country, A Memoir of Syria. And she writes about Syrian history, society, and politics. It's also a very personal memoir for her. She'll be speaking on Monday at Green Apple Books on the Park here in San Francisco, 1231 9th Avenue. The free event starts at 7:30. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about what's happening in Syria, specifically life in Syria, culture in Syria. We don't often hear about that. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Alia, you were talking about your parents in the 70s and 80s experiencing changes in Syria and how they had to sort of play by the rules. People felt like they were being watched. And when you went to Damascus in April 2011, you write that unlike in many cities, there is no anonymity in Damascus. There's no disappearing into it. Four different security bodies with at least 22 branches in the capital alone have for decades carried out the regime's surveillance of its people. They are much less a refined version of the Stasi, with very little of East German agency's precision or accuracy, but what they lack in sophistication, they more than make up for with gusto. And when you wrote from there, you couldn't use your name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the Syrian Mukhabarat are, that's what's so insidious about this. You know, and that's why it was also when people thought that they were going to displace the regime so quickly and easily in Syria as the Arab, sort of the excitement of the Arab Spring happened, you know, even though I was optimistic, like I knew that was naive. And people should understand that in residential neighborhoods, these branches are there. So it's not like there's this big ominous building somewhere on the outskirts of the city. No, there's a branch of the different Mukhabarat in every single neighborhood. And, you know, a lot of them have a dungeon in the basement. And so, and this is one of the things I try to explain, is that at the same time that a totalitarian regime makes victims of all its people, it also makes you a bystander. You know, I walked past this one branch every day on my way to the gym. You know, so I'm going to go do squats and lunges, but I know I'm sort of passing a site of torture. Wow. And, you know, or illegal detentions. What does that? So I'm just there. I've only lived in Damascus for those 2 years, although I had been a frequent visitor. But imagine the feeling of that complicity, even if you're not at fault, that complicity on you over 40 years. And these are the sorts of dynamics that, to me, have to be talked about, have to be understood before we start prescribing who we're going to arm and how we think we're going to quickly displace a regime like that.
Well, we have a few callers on the line. Sure. Let's hear from Philip in Brisbane. Hi, Philip. Welcome to the show.
Hello, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I wanted to make two quick comments. One was that I have two very upsetting impressions of Syria, and the first one is that after the Arab Spring, I saw on television a leader of a protest saying, "We literally, I mean literally, were carrying olive branches and only asking for a little more freedom, a little more leeway to be ourselves, and we were shot at. They opened fire on us." And I was in a conference room with an international group that I was working with at the time. No one cared. No one seemed surprised. That didn't bother anybody. That's just life. That's the world. That's number one. Number two is, I remember Thomas Friedman saying, and I'll have to paraphrase here, but saying, after our invasion of Iraq to topple Saddam Hussein, he said, we should send our suspects and prisoners to Syria so that our hands are not dirty by this, but they are good at getting information. They know how to handle these people. And I feel like if I was today to confront Mr. Friedman in an audience, I feel like I would be shouted down or booed. That's all I have to say, and maybe you'd like to take up on it. Perhaps I'm naive, or you may disagree, but I'll run over to my radio and turn it back on.
All right. Thank you, Philip.
Well, the first thing I want to just thank Philip for is reminding us that that is where this all began. It's true. Syrians didn't, unlike the Tunisians or Egyptians, did not call for the fall of the regime. They asked for some reforms, some end to the corruption. You know, the Assad regime is tight-knit in many ways, and there's sort of like there's one cousin that's sort of known as the family banker, and he, you know, he's been sort of like robbing the country blind for the benefit of you know, these small group of oligarchies. And you know, I think Syrians would have been initially quite satisfied with, you know, attempts at cutting down on that corruption. It's just, you know, they were asking to be met. But the regime, as Philip rightly points out, decided early on that the response it was going to take was a sort of all-or-nothing response. And I think, you know, wanted a strong show of force to dissuade anybody else from getting any further ideas as to whether or not the people he was with in the room cared or not. I mean, you know, well, he cares. So I'm gonna focus more on Philip than I am on him or the people he was in the room with or with Thomas Friedman. But that's true. That's when we have when we're willing to make these sort of morally ambiguous choices, right? Which we are making now today, because we say, okay, well, Assad, you know, he is sort of terrible and is, you know, this regime has caused the situation that we're in for a great part. But he wears a suit. He's clean shaven. He's not chopping people's heads off on TV. You know, for whatever reason, we feel like we'll use him to get rid of the other people that we've deemed sort of somehow more frightening. And this is the problem, I think, with short-sighted or limited, you know, politics. There has to be a sort of a more encompassing vision. And the reality is, I don't, you know, we want to make money. We want to have, we define power in certain ways. And so, yes, as always, the people on the ground eat the costs.
Thank you for calling in, Philip. Let's hear next from Tunlin in Oakland. Hi, Tunlin. Welcome to the show. Do we have Tunlin? Hi, I think. Are you there? Nope. We lost you. If you can call us back, we'll get you on. Talking about what people become used to, you have another section in your book that's really interesting about your trip to the West Bank and having conversations with people there. And you compared that with the conversations you have with people in Damascus.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that experience?
Yeah, so having, like I said, because my professions were hazardous to my health in Syria, it doesn't mean I didn't exercise them in other places. So I've lived in the West Bank, Gaza a few times. I'd lived in Lebanon. And it always was amazing to me that Palestinians, even under an Israeli occupation, even then under, you know, the Palestinian authorities, non-democratic authority to some extent, people still were free in their conversation. And that's something that had long been, like, wiped out in Syria. And that is something that is stunning. And which is why it's so distressing to see people want to attack freedom of speech or freedom of the press here in the United States at this point in time. Because these are the things that really, you know, are necessary to have any kind of hope. And that's why I was so, you know, when everything started in Syria, I already knew that 40 years of sort of, you know, stripping people of these rights, you at the same time strip them of the vocabulary. You kind of strip them of the of a muscle that which needs to be exercised. But yes, in the West Bank, Gaza, it was amazing how much more free. You know, I would in Egypt and other places in the Middle East, they all tell jokes about the people in power. You never, and I repeated one in Syria in 1992 that I had heard in Cairo, and everybody hushed me. You know, we were in a living room. We weren't out on the street. And so, yes, that's a kind of internal rot. I mean, there's lots of rot over in this world at the moment. But, like, that is a kind of internal rot that was very specific to Syria that I didn't experience in other parts of the Middle East, but I imagine existed in Saddam Hussein's Iraq.
When you talk about this to people, do you feel like they are at least trying to understand what it's like to live under an authoritarian regime?
I mean, depends. There are so many different audiences at this point. All I can do is sort of share what I think are, you know, what I think are the elements that people need to consider in what they discuss.
It looks like we have Tunlin back. Hi, Tunlin.
Hi, good morning. I want to thank Aaliyah and Rose for this discussion. I came as a refugee from Burma in 1970 during the ethnic cleansing there. And I grew up being conscious of the tragedy in Cambodia and Vietnam. And the story of Syria to me is very affecting, and it's very upsetting, just unbearable. But it took the American media almost 5 years to pay attention to it because of the increasing Russian and Iranian intervention and the geostrategic factors involved. But this is very difficult for me to speak up on. But the Aaliyah mentioned the empathy factor, which is very important, which became a turning point in the Vietnam War. And I am heartened by the anti-Trump protesters, the airport protests, the anti-Trump, anti-immigrant protests, the travel ban protests. But to me, this is not an immigration issue. This issue, as Aaliyah alluded to, is war. And there are so many players and so much of the great word that you use, rot in the world, from the Iranian involvement to the Russian involvement to U.S. complicity on the ground. Everybody has blood on their hands. And I think citizens of each country need to take responsibility. And I am trying to figure out, besides just feeling bad about it every night, hearing the news coming from Syria, what can we as American citizens, Iranian citizens, Russian citizens do, global citizens do? I think we can actually make Khamenei and Putin and Assad pay a price without the military threat. I think they're responding to the military threat. I think the global citizens can get together. I have a lot of Iranian friends who were active in the 79 revolution. Now, Iran is involved in this slaughter in Syria. I mean, we can all converge historically because I'm currently also thinking about the Rohingya Muslim refugees in Burma. It's all the same. All these stories overlap. Instead of activating ourselves based on one evil persona, this is a global phenomenon, this balkanization of the world.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Tunlin. What would you say, Aaliyah? A lot of people wonder where they should donate, what they can do. How do you answer that question?
No, thank you, Tunlin, for calling in and for sharing your experience. I do think it's important that, I mean, I don't think you have to have experienced genocide or war to be empathetic, but, I mean, you know, I'm sorry that you had to experience that to have that kind of empathy. But I do think it's important to open these conversations with each other, because one of the things I found dismaying in Syria was that people would say, you know, no other part of the world has experienced what we're experiencing. And when I walked with the refugees from Greece to Turkey, so many people would say, you know, no other part of the world has experienced what we've experienced. And we would have these conversations as we were walking through the former Yugoslavia. Wow. So, you know, I do think we need to talk to each other more and share our experiences with each other more. I think it also helps dispel the shame. It was interesting when I made that walk, how many, you know, Iraqis and Syrians were ashamed of the fact that they, you know, their great cities had crumbled and they had to seek refuge in a place like Germany. And I just remember saying, but do you know what Germany was like 70 years ago? It was completely destroyed by war as well. These failings aren't particular just to the developing world. And so, you know, thank you for sharing your experience with us. And it's true, you know, I had always wanted to write a book about Syria and my grandmother, but I only was able to get a book deal once the country became, you know, headline worthy. Mm. And so, yes, we also have to question why we only have empathy or curiosity about places when they're being destroyed. In terms of proactive things, there's many places to give money to. And I, you know, of course, there are the big organizations that work in all over the world. I prefer to give my family and I, we raise money for organizations founded by Syrians or Syrian Americans. And in our case, those three organizations have been INARA, INARA, which was founded by Syrian American CNN journalist Arwa Damon, which provides surgeries for children, mostly in Lebanon, who've been injured by the war. Besma and Zaytune, which is Lebanon based, also founded by Syrians. To provide services to Syrian refugees in Lebanon, and then Karam Foundation, which is based in Chicago, founded by Syrian Americans, which does work with mostly refugees, Syrian refugees inside Turkey. You can also volunteer, and like Tunlin, you know, I don't know how old you are or what, you know, shape you're in, but if you were to go volunteer either in this country with refugees who've been resettled here or in Greece or in camps, there are many opportunities for that as well. And then, you know, we are very lucky to live in a democracy, and we can hold our leaders accountable, and we can let them know that it's not just the Syrian Americans or the Muslim Americans or the Arab Americans who care about these issues, but that it's also the Burmese Americans and the Cambodian Americans. And, you know, similarly, you know, I think that's why Muslim Americans and Arab Americans are also trying to move into other spaces of solidarity, because I think alone we are not many, but we are many when we use that solidarity.
Thank you again for calling in, Tunlin. Let's go next to Irene in Berkeley. Hi, Irene. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you very much. I am. I've organized a fundraising concert at Freight and Salvage next Thursday night, May 11th, to raise money for Syrian humanitarian aid. So it seemed like a good call to let people know that they can come and contribute. Some of the very people we're talking about.
Did you say Freight and Salvage?
At the Freight and Salvage.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for calling in. We will go on the website, find the link, and we'll put it at Your Call Radio right after the show.
That's fantastic.
Okay. Thank you, Irene. Thank you for organizing that.
And thank you for this beautiful show.
Thank you. We have an email from a listener who says there is a critique going around of progressive and left commentators and media outlets about the characterization of the Syrian government. The claims are that there has in fact been low unemployment, general prosperity, social welfare programs, etc. I'm curious to hear Alia's perspective on the will of the people and how you describe society before the total destruction of those ancient cities.
So when the Hafez al-Assad regime came to power, specifically since you're speaking about the political economy, one of the best writers on this is Bassam Haddad. You know, basically in the 40 years of the regime, you saw it go from an authoritarianism of the left to an authoritarianism of the right. And so the coalition of the Ba'ath Party initially was more with this, you know, socialist and leftist groups. And they enacted policies of sort of nationalizing private property, private private farms and other companies. But then the Syrian currency crashed in the mid 80s, and so to sort of salvage the economy, what they began to turn to sort of more of an authoritarianism of the right. So yes, there was like the appearance of these neoliberal economic policies, but it became more of a sort of oligarchical way of controlling of resources and creating these sort of business networks between the regime and then these sort of new private sector actors that were created. But it was never a true free market economy. So it appeared to have some of the protections of the left that then it began to erode. So was the Syrian currency stable in Syria? Yes. Could you begin to get increasingly more Western goods, which before you couldn't? Yes. But there was also a greater stratification than there had been. You know, back in the 80s, it was sort of this idea that we were sort of all in this horrible situation together. There was, you know, it was hard to get bananas. It was hard to get tissue paper. There were things that you know, shortages of everything. But then you started to see all kinds of new wealth, and it became concentrated definitely in the hands of people who were regime affiliated. And let's say you had a good entrepreneurial idea. There was no way you were going to be able to actualize it without having to get in bed with somebody from the regime. And usually it came like this. Someone would come knock on your door and say, you know, we're now here to start being your partner, which is basically your cut. So, you know, this, we shouldn't look back at this with rose-tinted glasses. I mean, the reality is that stability came at a very, very high cost. It didn't tolerate dissent. You know, so if I were to practice my craft, or Rose, you were to practice your craft, we would probably be amongst those who would get that knock on the door in the middle of the night. And then, you know, what sort of, when the economy began to liberalize, it wasn't a real liberalization of the market. It was one that sort of kept concentrating wealth further and further into the hands of people affiliated with the regime. So, you know, I'm not an expert on this, but I'm telling you, Bassam Haddad is the person to read on this.
All right. Well, thank you for that email. We have just a couple minutes left, Alia, and we're getting a few emails from listeners saying, what is the solution at this point?
Well, I think we need to start asking different questions. You know, for so long, the question we've been asking is, how do we make the regime fall or not fall? And if we do want to make it fall, what military kind of intervention does that look like? And as Tunlan had sort of alluded to earlier, that's not the only tool in the toolkit. You know, military intervention is not the only toolkit. And if we start to ask different questions, I think we start to have different conversations. So the question I'm interested in is, how do we create a Syria that is safe and stable and where all its citizens, where citizenship is meaningful and all its citizens have equal rights, and we don't have this kind of level of corruption, and where all Syrians can actualize their potential? And once you start asking those questions, then, you know, I think the discussions you start to have is, how do we bring everybody whose hand is now in Syria to the table? Because there are many, many actors. And how do we, because now there is a constituency inside of Syria that does support the regime, you know, partly out of existentialist fears, partly out of fear. You know, there are Alawite communities that believe that they will pay the cost for, you know, the regime having an Alawite face, even though it, you know, that regime relies on the participation and acquiescence of a lot of the Sunnis, in fact, if you want to speak in sectarian terms. So how do we meet those fears that they might have? We have to bring everybody to the table, and we have to figure out a way to play. I think like I said, the Iranians and the Russians don't have the same interests with the Syrian regime. So we should need to figure out a way to pry them from each other and see which one is the player, that the partner that is more likely to be able to secure Syria.
And just quickly, a minute left. How do you bring those different factions to the table?
Yeah, you have to have the real will and really be serious about it. I think it's clear that we haven't. We haven't been. And let me just be perfectly clear, because there is no false. There's been a lot of false equivalency between, you know, ISIS and armed opposition and the regime. You know, the responsibility for a lot of the disintegration of Syria rests squarely on the shoulders of the regime. And so I don't see how you can move forward with Assad still at the head of it. And yeah, there's got to be accountability for those who have committed crimes.
Alia Malik is an award-winning Syrian-American journalist, and she's author of the new book, The Home That Was Our Country, A Memoir of Syria. She writes about Syrian history, society, and politics. And Alia will be speaking on Monday, May 8th at Green Apple Books on the Park in San Francisco. It's a free event, 1231 9th Avenue, and the event starts at 7:30. Alia, thank you so much for coming in. Thanks for writing your book.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.